This insert is brought to you by Radio K Pulpit 7 to 9 a.m. Please visit kpulpit.co.za.
Good evening, listeners. So we are on the final broadcast tonight for Women's Month, because it's still Women's Month and we're honoring women who are struggling with addiction, whether they are struggling with an addiction themselves or they are in a position where they need to, where they are partners, family member, friends, or maybe they have children that struggle with addictions. And we honor women in this situation. And this is why we have this program, not only for women, of course, but especially this month, we focused on working, having interviews specifically with women and to have a message for women as so many of us are really vulnerable when we struggle with this. And part of this, yes?
Suki, yeah, thank you very much for that intro, Suki. And we are saying very, very welcome to Emma. Thank you, Emma Gibbon. Thank you for joining us, Emma.
Thank you for having me.
So this month we are going to be talking about a woman and God's faithfulness, but not only women, but women's challenges and God's faithfulness. So in our first program, we spoke about how women in Scripture played a very, very important role in fulfilling the Scripture and fulfilling God's will. For whether it be for Israel or whether it is in the New Testament, but that women are facing challenges, seeing God's faithfulness amidst those challenges. So thank you very, very much for joining us.
Can you tell us a little bit of your story and how you got involved with this?
So I am now currently at CAD, which stands for Christian Action for Dependence. So our main focus is helping people with aftercare. So once they get out of the rehabilitation center, to ensure that they stay sober. So we do it via support groups, individual counseling, motivational sessions, also family counseling, because addiction isn't just about the individual, it's a family disease. So that is why we find it very important. I know maybe most of the listeners have watched movies where you hear someone go in a movie, "Hi, my name's Emma and I'm an alcoholic." So that would be Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholic Anonymous. And we are similar in the sense that we do have support groups, but we are different because we are run by professionals as well as recovering addicts.
Really interesting. I didn't know that.
And we also include the family members. So it's very important because I always say the addict goes through the rehab, but who helps the family with forgiveness, with understanding. So I got into this. I graduated from Stellenbosch University with my bachelor's in social work in, I think, 2017. And then I got the job before I even had my graduation. So it was the first job I ever interviewed for with regards to, you know, my social work degree. And I got the job, so I didn't have much of a holiday, but it was a blessing in disguise. And I started on the 2nd of January 2018, so not much of a New Year's, but it was really exciting. So getting paid for your passion, I think, doing something you love and being able to, you know, you actually feel guilty taking the money because you love it.
Yeah. But I remember when I started working, the first time I got paid, I thought, how can you get paid for this? This is so nice.
Exactly. So,
but may I ask, Emma, why is that your passion? Is there some kind of story that led you to this?
If I have to think back at my life, what made me want to do it, especially social work, it was never, I don't remember an exact moment, but I always knew I came from a very privileged home and a very loving home. And I think with that, I knew I had to give back and hopefully be able to help others. And I think when I was growing up, I was, you know, helped being raised by a caretaker, and she is my second mom. And she really introduced me to, you know, humble life and the communities. And she was one of them. She is. We're still in contact. One of the most loving people I've ever met, her name's Sophie. She would help people on the road. She didn't drink a sip of alcohol, but she would help people on the road. She, you know, helped us do our hair. We would have discussions. She introduced me to a whole different world. She burst, you know, like you live in a bubble for so long about having this privileged life that when that bubble gets popped in, you see this, wow, people less fortunate. I always knew I wanted to help. And when I was about, I actually have a, when I was about 2 years old, I had heart cardiac arrest. Like my heart stopped for, not a lot of people know this, but my heart would stop like 40 times a day. So when I was between the ages of 2 and 6, we were living in Montague, which is a very small little Afrikaans dorpie. But yeah, so no one could understand why was I passing out for, and then literally couldn't feel a heartbeat. So that happened from the ages of 2 and 6, and my mom was frantic, like, you know, rushing to doctors and hospitals, even would drive to Cape Town, come spend nights here, just trying to understand, going to, you know, I ended up even going to a neurologist and him, you know, clicking my neck and thinking I've epilepsy, taking like these, you know, getting tablets. I've gone to so many specialists and I've had the ambulance called many times. And I would always wake up or come, you know, back from it, what you call it, in the ambulance, and the doctor would be like, well, why do you need? Because your heart rate's fine, there's no evidence. And fast forward to when I was 6 years old, I was, had a heart monitor on me. So it was finally a cardiologist that saw me in Kelsuber, Dr. Simon, and he put a heart monitor on me. And he, so he checked it on me the weekend, and the Monday we took the heart monitor back. And I'll never ever forget, I was in the bath and with my sister and Sophie, my second mother, was barking us, and we got a house call, and they said, if you don't, you need to get your daughter to the hospital right now. Immediately. So we got in the car, freshly bathed, and that night I had an operation and I received a pacemaker. And then, because Dr. Simon said on the heart monitor, my heart would flatline in one night 50 times. And it was a third degree heart block, and he said, which is very special, and my mom only told me this later in life because, you know, I was only 6 years old, but, you know, we had the priest come there and obviously just give a blessing just before my operation because it was so, you know, sudden. And my mom told me years later that Dr. Simon said to them, I'm a man of science. I'm not a believer. I believe in facts, and I've been studied my whole life to see that. But the only reason your daughter is alive is because of God. So I think finding that out is really, you know, always stuck with me, and I always knew, and we can never understand what type of psychological effect it had on me being past, you know, losing breath, losing my heartbeat, you know, so many times a day for such a young age. I don't think we can ever understand maybe what that did to me, you know, on a spiritual level. But I think it's definitely brought me to this calling to know that I've got a purpose on this earth, and yeah, it's my duty to fulfill it. And when it comes to addiction, to fast forward to addiction, I never had, if you want me to be honest, God also knows, I never had sympathy or empathy with people with addiction. I always thought, now I'm fast forwarding, going, I'm looking at these people that are, you know, unfortunate. And then I'm like, and when I look at their middle class, whatever, I'm like, why are you doing drugs? You know, this is a choice and you're choosing to have a bad life. And it didn't make sense to me. And then in my fourth year of practical, I was placed in Tuffluch Rehabilitation Center in Worcester, a very good place. And that year, when I was, you know, helping people, I realized no one chooses addiction. You know, no one wakes up one morning and goes, I want to be an addict. It's all the circumstances that led to it, that we didn't have the capacity to deal with it anymore, that we led us to substance or process addiction in order to cope with our pain. I was very humbled. And, you know, God placed me in my first job in an addiction place, and now I'm completing my PhD in addiction studies. So when I say it's been an interesting journey, but I'm very blessed and grateful for it.
Thank you so much, Emma, for sharing that. Give us some insight. I really appreciate what you were saying with regards to your relationship with Sophie, your second mom. And, you know, because this month is Women's Month, how was your relationship with your mother?
Obviously it was, you know, really good in the sense that, I mean, she was, really helpful, because actually she was originally the one with the heart problem. She has cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
And her father, she didn't have a relationship with him. Her father was an addict, and he actually went to one of, I only found this later in life, so I don't want to talk about it, but he was in one of the rehabs, the remote in Paro, one of the rehabs there, while he was, you know, while throughout his life he went there for alcohol dependency. So my mother, obviously, is something that we have to consider in our lives, the genetic predispositions, you know, with my parents, me, my sister, because it does run in the family.
Right.
But my mother was, you know, a home mom. She was always there. I mean, she was the person that was by my side. Apparently, I was inseparable because, you know, when something went wrong, when I passed out or I just, you know, my heart stopped, she was the one that I would always hold on to, because it would happen when I was in the bathroom. And the reason we actually got my second mom, Sophie, was because they couldn't be watching me all the time. So if I was bathroom and had a pass out, I would have maybe drowned, you know, just an example. Or on the playground, because I'm very hyper. So on the playground, I pass out on the swing and then I hit my head, you know. So it was really a blessing in disguise that everything just came together. But my mom was really, you know, she was the rock, especially for not understanding what's going on with your daughter. I can't imagine. And then having a second daughter, and then trying to, you know, not give me too much attention, but also be there for my sister, who's 2 years younger than me. So I do definitely commemorate and appreciate all that she's done, and her and Sophie. So, it's made me really appreciative just growing up and seeing how hard it is, definitely.
Emma, I love your story, and we need to take a break. I just want to summarize before we take the break that I see God's redemption through women, even in your story, because especially if you say your grandfather had an addiction problem, isn't that amazing that your mother didn't have it, but with this terrible thing that she had with a little girl passing out and her heart stopped. I mean, I really honor your mom. I don't know how she did what she did, but the fact that the Lord kept you alive and that you now helping people with addictions, isn't that amazing to see God's redemption through the women and the women that he placed in your life, your mom and your second mom. But let's take a break, and then we talk more about choice afterwards. I've got more questions to ask about that. Thanks. Emma, welcome back. You've mentioned just before we concluded with what we said about your mother and your second mother, you mentioned something about choice. You said you thought you had no sympathy with addicts because you thought it was a choice that they made. Can you tell us more about it? Because you said during your practical, you realized that it wasn't so. But I think there are still many people that think, that don't have sympathy, that feel just the way you did. Tell us more about that. Explain to us.
So, you know, when I say it's not a choice, I think there's so many, you know, when I did my master's and now this is my PhD, I'm doing it from a perspective of biopsychosocial perspectives. And what that means is that there's a biological, psychological, social, and then also within South Africa context, cultural aspect. So when we look at biological, when I say it's not a choice, I really mean if your father or your mother or your great-grandfather or your grandfather was an addict, ready, you are more predisposed genetically. Then we look at the social, or let's go to psychological aspect. If you've got, you're predisposed to mental disorders, depression, anxiety. And often we see that with people, you know, indulge in alcohol because society accepts it so much. And then they realize, then they start self-medicating because they've got depression. And instead of going to a doctor and being diagnosed and maybe getting on medication, they self-medicate to alcohol. And they don't even know they're doing it at the time, but that's what happens. Then we go to social aspects. Where are you living? The accessibility and availability of drugs. And also our neighborhoods, are they gangs? If we're talking about more our low-income households, is it more socially accepted? Is it the norm? How am I going to go through a child where both parents were smoking and weed the whole day and tell them not to do it? Our parents are our role models. So that has been also very challenging. So when I say with choice, it really is, say now they don't even know that there is a choice to be made. Say now it's just the next step in life. Like, we know that we have to go off, you know, when we breastfed, that we have to go off it in order to maybe not be so dependent on our mothers, for example. That's the next logical step in our lives. But what if we don't know that there's a choice to be made when it comes to being interested? Yes, take a drag of a cigarette. We didn't even think it was a choice. We just thought it was the next step in our, you know, growing up, social development. Then we look at the cultural aspect of, you know, we have to look at cultures and what is more predisposing. We see maybe more in the white communities, you'll get more alcohol, you'll get more processed addiction when it's gambling, internet, sex, etc. Then we get more the colored community in South Africa, where we'll get more tuck. We'll get also a little bit more, definitely alcohol from the dorp system. And then we go to more African when we're talking about isiXhosa, Zulu. We are definitely at CABC more alcohol than ever in the past. That it's actually become such a problem, and people don't know how to deal with it in the Khoisan communities because it's never been a problem in the past. So we have to look at that cultural aspect. So when it comes to choice, sometimes people do not have even realize the choice someone wants to make because they don't know the difference between wrong or right. And then also, because society is so socially accepted, alcohol, I mean, you get it in your food, you get it in, mouthwashes. So when we have, and I think the word predisposed is so important. I think in life, we all have the capacity to deal with something. And then life gets to hand us trauma. So when we dealt with a capacity, say now your capacity is a 1 liter bottle and my capacity is a 500 ml. Who's going to be quicker filled up with capacity and trauma? I've got less room for trauma in my life. And then once I reach that capacity of 500 ml, my bottle is overflowing. And that is where we have this mental breakdown. We have this absolute, you know, existential crisis of who am I? And we often find comfort in socializing with the wrong people because we have this sense of belonging. And you know what makes us feel good? Substances you know, stimulant activities such as porn or such as TV, such as things like that. So we want instant gratification. But we need to, there's no such thing as, oh, you chose it. There is so much underlining, like I said, taking back to the biopsychosocial perspective of looking at all the underlining things that, you know, equal to addiction.
So thank you very much, Emma. Very good explanation with regards to all the different routes where
that's why people lose track, and so it works with my clients.
You know, because we are talking about Women's Month, we are talking about women that are involved either in addictions or trying to help the addict. In CAD, what proportion of women are coming to you for help?
Okay, so now this is a very interesting, because I actually did my honors thesis on this about women and addiction. So what we have found is, because of historically, you know, men be the patriarch and women more being, you know, they can't really have problems. And I know it sounds harsh, but it's almost like they have to be the strong figure. They have to be, you know, hold the house together, the home together. So it has been a thing of a male problem for, you know, many generations prior to this. So what has happened is a lot of our rehabilitation centers, et cetera, have been more equipped, you know, to cater for the men. But I must say it's not available for the women. But a lot of the time we feel women don't even realize when they have a problem or don't know where to go because they are a single mother or, you know, it's their daughter and they don't want to leave their child behind because they have to go to a rehab. But they don't think it's an option. So what happens is we do get more males. However, we do get women, and it's very important to note this, that in the Western Cape currently, we do not have any rehab for women under 18 years old. So what that means is I'm getting clients that are 16 years old in my office. And I'm telling the parents, you know what? Sorry. Guess what? You're going to probably have to wait until we get a bit older. So the problem gets almost worse. It's because, you know what? We don't have help right now. And that's the worst thing when our hands are tied. You know, there's really nothing we can do. So women have become sometimes being not forgotten, but they, you know, the focus isn't really on them, and we don't have sometimes resources to, equipped to help them. Mm. So yeah, it's definitely been something that we've, you know, been brought to our attention.
Mm.
But we do get women. We do get women at coming to us, definitely, as well. But definitely more men at this point.
And if you compare the women to men, are their problems different? Do they come to you earlier? Do they come later? What do you see? What's different if you look at people coming with... Yeah?
So definitely the man would be more... I struggle more with the ego and the pride. Mm-hmm. So it's something that I have to really, you know, help my clients with. So sometimes they do come much later in life, or it was a partner, a.k.a. say now a woman, or a parent. You know, kicking them out, this is your last choice, this is your last option, and then having the mother or the girlfriend or the wife bringing them to us, okay? Mm. Where it's often we see the woman would either come up by themselves.
Mm.
First, they would have attempted to try and get sober by themselves, or they will come out by themselves and ask us for help.
Mm.
And if it's like regarding a daughter, often more... And when it comes to children, I really just want to reiterate this, like, when it comes to a child, it's always the mother, really, because the single-headed households, you know, absent fathers in South Africa is very extreme.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the time it's going to be the mother bringing their son,
mm-hmm.
the mother or the grandmother bringing their son or daughter. So, yeah, it's something that we have noticed, and statistically speaking, it does, the, you know, the stats speak for itself.
Mm-hmm. My heart really goes out to women as I listen to you. And one of the previous programs, I quoted Mao Zedong saying that women keep up half the sky. And I think you really see that in your line of work. And that's also why women are so vulnerable and really need support. So what will happen if they come to you? How will you go about helping them, especially family members and friends? We don't have a lot of time, Emma, so if you can try and do it in a minute or two.
Hmm. Okay, so just to end off, we help, like I said, we offer care. However, we find it very beneficial if we can walk a process with our clients. So we tell them, come to us or book a session through our website or through our number on WhatsApp, and then come to our office and we can help you fill out the forms for various rehabs that are existing, that are government-based, so subsidies and a little payment. And then we will help you fill in the application, then send it off to the rehab, and then it's up to the rehab, you know, to accept you, to look through your details, and then once you get out of the rehab, you already have established a connection with CAD, meaning you will already be able to have a support group option close to you, which is the most important part, because I want to end off with this. This is a fact. 75% of people relapse 3 to 6 months after rehab, which means in aftercare. This means people are going to aftercare or aren't taking it serious. So aftercare is the most important part. Mm. So we want people to come to us and walk a process. There is no time limit. Aftercare sobriety is lifelong. It is a lifelong work. Just because if you had cancer, you have to go for checkups to check if you're still in remission or you have to go back into treatment.
Mm.
So I really want to reiterate that we do help people walk that process, so they must be in contact with us.
Do you have a have a psychosocial program as well for friends and family that you know, to teach them skills?
So even if the addicts themselves don't want help, we obviously are there to just provide support for the family. You know, how can now you have a relationship with someone that's an addict, and how can you have maybe tough love? We can talk about options of that, interventions we've done. So yeah, it's just, you know, just coming up with a program that could work there.
Where are you? Are you all over the country?
So we are national, but our offices are in Tails River, and we're the only office of professionals. The rest is, all the other support groups national are run by recovering addicts.
Okay. And so are you online as well? Can people find you online?
Yes. Through Cushion Action for Dependents and CAD, they can get various numbers for various areas in the country.
Okay. Thank you so much, Emma. That was very insightful.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Emma, for being with us for our program today. And also just once again showing us that women with challenges are very often supported by other women.
Mm.
And that it's the women that reach out for help, whether they are the addict or whether they are wanting to support the addict in a correct way.
And to see also God's faithfulness through their program. We didn't even have time to talk about the Christian program and exactly what you guys
do. We're going to have to do this again sometime.
Yes, definitely. We're going to invite you to come back.
So thank you, listeners, for being with us. Thank you so much, Emma. Listeners, you can get to our podcast at www.kpulpit/podcasts/IntoMeC. And please write to us at frederick.suki@kpulpit.co.za. Thank you once again, and we'll see you next week again. Thank you and blessings. Goodbye.
This insert was brought to you by Radio K Pulpit, 7 to 9 a.m. Please visit kpulpit.co.za.